I'll talk about consistency tests. I'd be happy to talk about the paper, but I might not say anything nice.
Okay, should I go forward?
Sure, yeah. So no punk talk, I think, should begin at least. Well, and I should say that I'm going to necessarily be giving a very HFI-centric punk talk, simply because that's what I'm familiar with. You've got local experts there. Peters, I think, is in the crowd, who can inform you about the LFI instrument far better than I could. But no punk talk, no HFI talk, at least, should start without looking at what the timelines look like. And so this first slide is just a raw timeline showing you what the data look like at each of Ponk's, the HFI frequencies on Ponk. So starting at the top is the 100 gigahertz, and it goes down to the submillimeter channels with the 857 gigahertz, the second to last row, and then the bottom one is a dark detector. And so what you see in that are a number of things. First of all, you see a bunch of hash, which are our beloved cosmic rays, that are continuously pinging our instrument. And then riding on top of that, at least with the lower frequencies, you can see that the dipole, which is the scan synchronous component, the sinusoid, which is just running along as you'd expect, interrupted periodically by the bumps, which are that happen twice per period, which are the galactic plane crossings. And then if you were to zoom in close enough, you'd see actually in the HFI, you would see with quite high signal to noise in the timeline, the degree scale temperature anisotropies floating past. So that's what the timelines look like. And then there's obviously a great deal of processing that has to happen or massage those data into something that's scientifically useful. And so the next slide is an indicator of what happens in that massaging. So in a normal Miracle curves. And then we get to our third slide. And we wind up with an image of what the primordial population looked like. So I'm not talking much about that the previous slide. I'd be happy to if people have questions about it. I will talk about some of the implications of some of those effects that were evident in that timeline later on in the talk. But for now, we're left with a map of the temperature fluctuations in the background. This is the component-separated map. So this is just the CMB component extracted, the combination of all of the HFI frequencies in the LFI as well. And these maps of the full sky don't do Ponk justice because the resolution that you can plot these images at are insufficient to capture the detail that's in the data. So I've gone ahead. You can see a little square on the full sky map that indicates a region that we're going to look at in detail. And I've just looked up images from some different data sets of that region of sky, all of them being filtered so that all you see is the sex plateau. So these are all filtered out, so you're seeing fluctuations that are on order of 2 degrees or so in the sky. And which is starting from the left to the right. You see the boomerang data from 2003 and the WMAND, WMAP data from the 7-year release. And then on the right is the HFI 143 gigahertz map. And so you can see that the two satellite missions see exactly the same image on the sky, and they see an image which is similar to what we knew to be on that part of the sky from some of the ground-based, the suborbital missions prior to that, with much less fidelity on those larger scales. So if you go to the next slide. This is the same patch of sky, but now filtered, the upper row is filtered to capture the oscillations. So roughly speaking, between an angular scale, a multiple of sort of 100 out to about 900. And you see that, and it's the same three experiments, boomerang, WMAP, and HFI on the right. And there's, first of all, great deal of visual agreement in the two maps. There's essentially no noise in either of the boomerang or HFI maps. And if you look, you can see a bit of half in WMAP maps. But most of what you're seeing is just the high signal noise image of the acoustic oscillations in the CMB. So then you can go on and do the next step and look at the sort of third region of the CMB structure, which is the subcamping. So basically angular scales, of course, pulls above 600 to 800, and that's what's shown in the bottom row. And there, clearly in the middle, the WMAP doesn't have much to say about what's happening on those smaller angular scales, simply because it hadn't the beam size activity to measure them. The boomerang data in the deep field, in the boomerang deep field, is about the same unit of noise as the Planck data are, but of course only covering a fraction of a percent of the sky, whereas the Planck data cover the whole sky. And one of the interesting things about the lower right most plot is that there's really no low pass done to the data at all, and yet you see structures that appear to be quite smooth, and that's simply just the intrinsic low pass filter on the sky from silk damping. The HFI data are pretty unique in that there's essentially no noise on these scales whatsoever. Next slide, please. So you can continue that argument down to even smaller scales. This is an image that Merhat made of comparing the ACT field, which is the lower panel, with the same field of the sky as observed from Planck. And you see that there's a just sort of a brilliant correlation in structure on the sky, extending all the way down to the limit of the beam size of Planck. And then below that, you see the smaller scale fluctuations in the ACT data that Planck cannot resolve. So it's a remarkable series of experiments. Planck alone has measured the temperature fluctuations on the sky across more than three orders of magnitude in angular scale. Next slide, please. The next slide is a famous plot for boomerang. So boomerang in the 2003 flight, from the data that you saw there, you could drive an angular power spectrum, and those are shown in alternate bindings in red and in green. Overplotted with the recently released Planck power spectrum, which are in black, and as well as the ACT data from 2012 are shown in yellow, which unfortunately is hard to see. And the model there is actually the best fit boomerang model, and it did a fairly good job of predicting Planck data. Now, that's not a fair comparison by any means, because on the scale of this plot, you can't see the highly statistically significant differences in that cosmology. But it's an indicator of just how far the field has come, that we're now very robustly measuring these fluctuations across one of the seven peaks in the power spectrum. So just to amplify that, the next slide shows and a different scale shows the sort of current best measurements of the angular power spectrum, extending from the whole sky down to angular scales limited by the SPT beam down. This actually cuts off at a multiple of 3,000. The SPT data continue with high signal noise quite twice as far in angular scale. Next slide. So getting back to the data, this is the Planck power spectrum. The best panel has been removed from the data in the lower panel, and what's left are the residuals. The green line shows the envelope of the total error, which is the combination, of course, of sample variance up to about L of 1500, and then a combination of noise and degeneracy with the likelihood modeling of the foregrounds out at smaller angular scales than that. The Planck uses a sort of a hybrid estimator. It uses a Gibbs sampler on a component separated map, which covers a little bit more than 87% of the full sky at multiples below L of 40. And then it uses a pseudo CL estimator out at the smaller angular scales. And the initial takeaway that you should have is just the sort of remarkable ability of a basic six parameter lambda CDM cosmology to capture all the information content in those images of the full sky all the way down to two arc minute resolution. It's an enormous feat of data compression. Next slide, please. You've probably heard ad nauseum by now, just a quick summary of the cosmology coming out of the Planck release. Just to note that the lambda CDM best fit cosmology is really driven by the smallish angular scale fluctuations. So from a multiple of about 80 to 2,000, and that drive cosmology. And one of the unique things is that in that angular scale that previously hadn't been limited by sample variance. The fact that we've been able to reach the sample variance limit at those relatively small scales extending out to the soak damping tail means that we're able to detect the lensing. And that's really helped with breaking the geometric degeneracy by both a combination of the lens temperature power spectrum as well as the lensing power spectrum itself. And the cosmology that comes out has more virions and dark matter than we had thought, a bit less cosmological constant. It changed by not a great deal, but probably by more than most of us expected. There's excellent improvement with BBN and BAO acoustic scale measurements, which is really quite remarkable, and I'll talk about it a bit more in a minute. Scale invariance is ruled out at over 5 signals from the CMB alone in these data. But we also end up having a consequence of the above points is that we get a low H-naught relative to HST. And another thing that I'll focus on a bit in this talk is that we really don't have any evidence for, and even the data disfavor fairly strongly, extensions beyond the basic six model, which is sort of a remarkable statement. There's no reason that nature had to have thrown that curveball at us to be so simple, but she appears to have done that. There's not much evidence in favor of anything beyond the three standard neutrino species, or for curvature, a running index, dynamic dark curvature, sterile neutrinos, you name it. And furthermore, there's not any evidence for any interesting level of non-Gaussianity, at least up to the level of about FNL of 6 for the local type. And above L of 40, there's a just phenomenal agreement with lambda CDM on the one hand, and also with all other observations, CMB observations at the smaller scales. Below L of 40, the story's a little bit different. There are some interesting anomalies relative to the best fit lambda CDM model. And there are anomalies for which the chi-square doesn't tell the whole story. So we'll talk about that in a bit more detail. And finally, there's a fairly complicated, I think, disagreement with WMAP on what the sky looks like in terms of the overall structure and amplitude of the CMB emission. And I'll talk about that in a bit of detail. Okay, so real quickly, this is the four-year COBE DMR map showing you the first detection of fluctuations in the microwave background with modest signal noise and angular resolution. And what's remarkable is that with Planck now, not only have we basically squeezed all the information out of the temperature anisotropies that were first detected by the DMR. We're able to massage those data and provide us with the next slide, which is a map of the lensing potential that's seen by Planck at basically the same resolution as COBE and sort of roughly the same signal to noise as COBE had on the temperature fluctuations. So this is a map of the estimated total matter density back to the epoch of last scattering. And that's a remarkable thing. It's very convenient for us. In that it allows the CMB alone to measure a bunch of things which had previously been degenerate. You can derive from the lensing potential, you can get the lensing power spectrum, which is the next slide. And it's detected, the lensing is detected more than 25 sig, which sort of just adds on the previous high significance detections from ACT. Next, please. So this is the triangle plot showing basically what I said before about how cosmology has changed with Planck. It's changed incrementally, but interestingly. So what are plotted here are the distributions for Planck plus the lensing. So that's using the lensing likelihood, as well as the Planck temperature power spectrum data. That's shown in, as the black curves. The red are Planck data, along with the WMAP polarization. And just to be clear, that means that we're using WMAP Q and U maps and Planck temperature maps in the likelihood, in the polarization likelihood. The sort of light gray line is the cosmology from WMAP, whatever it says there, 9, yeah. And in color are the are encoded the H-naught values for samples
for the case where we are just using the PONC plus lensing, so not using the WMAP polarization. And I think sort of, Mark, if you look down, the second to last row is kind of remarkable. Just using the lensing alone, you're able to measure the tau, the reionization, in a way which is totally independent of the polarization, which, you know, the polarization measurement is a difficult one. And it's actually remarkable that that the lensing derived optical depth and the polarization derived optical depth are in such good agreement. Next slide. So here are some more illustrations of the power of the lensing to constrain parameters with Planck. So these are showing the distributions, the joint distributions for omega lambda and omega matter, also encoded with H naught encoded by color. And the plot is just a zoomed version of the leftmost. So you can see that by adding the lensing information to the Planck temperature power spectrum and the high L data, you can really just nail down the cosmology that we live in without recourse to any external data sets. So just to be clear, the dashed line is a flat profile. And the thing that you should be looking at are the zoom input on the right. The black contours are showing the Planck plus high L WMAP polarization, which is all CMB, plus the lens, which is derived from the CMB data, from the Planck CMB data. And then we can go even further by adding in the BAO data, just nail down in a model-independent way, both H naught, quite clean measurement of H naught, also the fact that the importance cosmology with it seems to be flat. Next slide, please. This is a plot showing the consistency between the acoustic scale distance you infer from the CMB data and that that you measure directly with the large scale structure. So the gray hashed area is that scale derived from the Planck data and the high L. So that means actants. So data, not polarization data, and power spectrum. And it's an absolutely beautiful agreement with all of the BAO data that are shown there. This is a bit at odds with what the situation looked like earlier. In the next slide, you can see the WMAP 7 plus SPT comparison in red. And there's a bit of tension there. It was marginal, but things have really kind of snapped together most recently. And that's true not only of the BAO data, but also with BBN. So the next slide is one of several plots that are in the parameters paper, showing the consistency between primordial helium and deuterium measurements. So AVER is the helium, and the other two are deuterium in the sort of purple half. And Planck, well, not just Planck, all of the CMB data, so Planck WMAP polarization and the ACT data provide the contour. And everything looks in good agreement, even when you allow the number of radiative species to float along with omega baryon. And in this here, the YP is fixed to the BBN prediction from NF and from omega baryon. Next slide, please. So the place where we don't quite have that degree of consistencies in H naught, we've really come down quite a bit from where we thought we were with the HST values. So in the most recent Reese and Friedman results, we're a couple sigma off from the more local H naught determinations. We're not in such bad agreement with WMAP 9, but again, the Planck values drive just from the CMB alone now. And I think that the most powerful thing about Planck is the ability to say things like this in a way which is very model independent. So in the next slide, which is almost impossible to read, is one that if you haven't already, you could stare at the parameter paper. At single parameter extensions to the basics model and seeing to what degree the data favor levels of application from that most basic parameterization of the cosmology. And see them as the light hashed lines are the baseline values for the lambda CDM cosmology. And the blue contours are showing, well, the red are showing the Planck data and Planck lensing, and the blue are showing the Planck along with the BAO data. And what you find is that for essentially any extension, whether it's curvature or neutrino mass or the number of radiative degrees of freedom or dynamical dark energy, the data strongly disfavor any substantial departure from lambda CDM in all of those quantities. And that's what I didn't know before. So this is really something that Planck has added to the picture. The cosmology didn't change, but that's a statement about nature more than a statement about the data. The Planck has enough horsepower that if any of these extensions were in fact the case, Planck would be able to say something about them in a way that WMAP couldn't. And nature's chosen to be more modest about things. It's quite a quite natural cosmology that we live in, depending on your natural. So back to this, that's sort of the top level. I want to talk a little bit about the non-Gaussian entropy results. And in particular, I think there's some interest in, from the point of view of the experimentalists, of how robust these are and what some of the challenges are. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And then we'll talk a bit about some of the anomalies on the sky and also the tension with WMAP in the calibration. So the next slide is the non-Gaussianity result. So the one you should be looking at is the ISW lensing subtracted column. And basically, it's limiting the local type to something less than about 6 at 1 sigma. That's a remarkable statement, given the first slide that I showed, in showing in all its glory quite how ugly the raw data are. And so I certainly was skeptical about how well we'd be able to actually get at this. So in the next couple of slides, I want to try to convince you that this is actually quite robust. And the next slide shows an image of the full sky. And what this actually is the estimate of the noise on the sky in the component separated from BMAP. Now, what you should really be taking it away as is an indicator at some level of the integration time distributed on the sky. Where there's blue, there's a great deal of integration time, and where there's red, it's less dense. You can also see where the where foregrounds are particularly bad and are masked out even in the component separated map, or in painted, as they say. So a couple takeaways. One, the coverage is not homogeneous at all. The integration time is by no means uniform on the sky. And in the next plot, we have a map here, just two frequencies selected. The left column is the 150 gigahertz Planck data, and the right column is the 857 gigahertz Planck data. The top row just shows the raw map. The lower two rows for each column show a particular null test. So you divide the data into two subsets which have roughly equal statistical weight, and you difference them and you see what's left over. First one is the first of those two are the half ring difference maps, which you'll see referenced in the non-Gaussianity paper. Those are where, you know, Planck scans on essentially great circles in the sky that are roughly 45 minutes in duration between repointings. And you can imagine just taking half of that ring and calling that one data subset and half of the other as the other independent data subset, and then creating null maps from the difference of those two products. And that's what the middle row is. The bottom was the survey difference. So you take one six-month period and difference it from the other six-month period. So these are susceptible to very different systematics. And the bottom row is essentially a catch-all, every systematic we can imagine. That's sort of the optimally bad thing you can do with the data. Now, neither one of these are necessarily representative of the level of systematics that are in the sum data. They do give you an idea about some of the effects that are there. So if you look for a minute just at the leftmost columns, the 150 gigahertz detectors, you don't see much of anything in the second row. You do see a fair amount of, you see some striping, but most of that can just be attributed to the variation in integration time on a ring. The bottommost row, you see residuals of the galactic plane, which have something to do with a combination of nonlinearity and the asymmetry in our beams, or the effective beam. But again, aside from those two things, there's not much that jumps out at you. And note the very different scale, temperature scale on those maps, 5 microkelvin for the ring difference and 15 microkelvin peak to peak, I guess 30 microkelvin for the survey difference. And then for the 857 gigahertz for the second column, things aren't quite as good. There's more striping evident even in you know, on sort of half-hour time scales. And then there's a lot of rich and interesting stuff in the bottom rightmost plot, which are kind of fun to talk about. Now, none of these affect any of the data. Again, these are nearly to terahertz, so they're not actually used at all in the analysis that goes into non-Gaussianity. But they're indicative of, they're sort of giving you an idea of what might be lurking at a very low level in some of the CMB data, a level which is difficult to visualize, but might still be there if you looked carefully enough. And what you see are a couple things. You see at the, these are black coordinates, obviously, and at the black, you see at both the north and the south, you see sort of what we refer to as the sort of boomerang-shaped red spots there, map. And then you see a more interesting shape that runs through the ecliptic, as a sort of a series of rings that run from the bottom left to the upper right of that survey difference map. And what those are respectively, the bananas at the galactic poles are sidled over the primary. And so it's an optical effect. It's an instrumental artifact that is present at some level in the other frequencies, and is very evident in 857 gigahertz data. And the other thing which runs around the ecliptic, that's actually zodiacal light that's remaining in the map. There's a paper that goes in some detail about our understanding of that and the level at which it's likely to be present down at the millimeter wavelength, in the CMB bands. We don't think it's a big deal there. But these just give you an idea. Well, of course, the elephant room is that there's a great deal of other stuff going on, which doesn't have a simple explanation. So all of those are much worse at 857 gigahertz than they are in the CMB channels. But qualitatively, you might expect similar, their distant cousins to be living down in the noise floor of the CMB data. So why do we think that none of this affects the Gaussianity stuff at the significant level? We can go to the next slide. This is a difficult to read slide that's just grabbing the tables from the non-Gaussianity paper, where essentially those null products that I described are used in order to estimate are run through exactly the same analysis pipeline in order to derive in a model independent way the level of non-Gaussianity that's intrinsic to the instrument and our observation of the sky. These potentially no significant non-Gaussianity left in the data, despite the fact that there are some identifiable, they don't appear to have any impact on the non-Gaussianity. So these null tests in the non-Gaussianity, I think, are the strongest argument for why you ought to believe these results. There's it's especially the survey difference is essentially a catch-all, the worst of what could be in the data. And this is a completely model-independent statement about the robustness of the result. Okay, next. Similarly, we can ask how, you know, of course, the non-Gaussianity is very important for inflation. The other very significant item that Planck has brought to the table that previously had been hinted at but wasn't there quite with the statistical significance that Planck has are the break from scale invariance, so the NS less than one result. And you might ask how robust is that, both to the sort of instrumental effects we're talking about, but also, and probably more importantly, to issues having to do with the treatment of galactic foregrounds. So at the small angular scales, the contribution of the galactic foregrounds in the temperature power spectrum is quite large. Fairly large corrections are having to be made, and the modeling is done in the harmonic domain and is not by any means that. So in order to get a handle on how robust the NS result is to all of these things, these plots are kind of helpful. These are from the cosmology paper. And they're showing the likelihood distributions in NS and omega baryon, omega matter, and the top row. And then encoded in the color scale are the samples in varying lensing amplitude. So this is really just a scaling of the lensing of the CMB power spectrum. And it's that is used as a template and let flow and see what the data prefer. What you find is that those are samples, and that the Planck plus WMIL contours are shown in black. And what you find is that everything looks good, and in fact, NF result being less than one is very robust, even if you take the extreme excursions of this lensing amplitude. And this lensing amplitude you shouldn't take to be lensing. We have no reason to believe that this has anything to do with lensing, but it is a catch-all for the combination of systematics and foregrounds lurking in the likelihood analysis. It really is comforting. So two things that are comforting. One, that regardless of that all the samples in that distribution are consistent with NS being less than one, and that those which have this lensing amplitude near one, the blue dots, are all quite consistent with what we have in the joint likelihood. So I think the takeaway here is that the NS result is really quite robust, and it's robust using just CMB data. Next slide. So this is the plot that I guess made the cover of the Primordial Cosmology wiki page.
It should be. This is the update.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, this should be the updated.
Yeah. So you all probably know more about how fascinating this plot is than I do. So I'll only speak to the sort of where we are and where we're headed in terms of adding plots. So Planck really much our belief about what the tensor to scalar ratio is. It was up at about 0.12 before Planck's release, and it's been pushed down a bit in tensor to scalar ratio with the Planck data. What's more important, of course, is the limit, is the more stringent limit on the primordial tilt on the one hand, and then of course the absolutely new thing is the limit on the noun Gaussianity, which is really constrained just the inflation model, but also excluded many previously perfectly viable alternatives in cyclic universes and in more complicated multi-field versions of inflation. What are the prospects for improving on the situation in terms of being able to exclude more of the parameter space? I think that these results, hopefully I've convinced you that these results are pretty robust, the ones that we have so far. And then the second question is, how much better can we do, both with Planck and with the upcoming Silverado experiments? And isn't going to improve much on the non-Gaussianity from where it is now. Where it will improve is in the release of the polarization data. You might hope that we'll be able to both on the NS result, but also on the tensor to scalar ratio. The tensor to scalar ratio could come from any number of places. Go to the next slide. There's a couple of snippets from some papers. So there's Grischuk has been banging it on the table for many years about how we have things wrong. In fact, we're going to detect tons of polarization. But even he was hedging his bets a bit, as indicated there. And of course, he's referring to the detection of the B mode power spectrum. There are other approaches to probing tensor to scalar ratio. There's the tensor contribution to the TE power spectrum, which is something I want to talk about a little bit. It's never been the favored way of probing the tensor to scalar ratio, but in a regime where the noise is not substantially lower than the B signal, it actually is a fairly competitive way of improving on your R limit. If we can go to the next slide. The state of the art in B bone measurements is this. This is a calculation from the quiet lab showing the current state of the field in polarization. The upper panel is showing the E mode polarization, and the lower the B mode. The best upper limits, first of all, there are a bunch of very robust detections now, measurements of the E mode power spectrum, extending all the way down to a multiple of 50 or so. And in the E mode, there are only upper limits, and they're gradually being pushed down, although more slowly than we'd all like. They're being pushed down to levels of tensor scalar ratio that are almost interesting. We're not quite up to the statistical power of limits that are derived from the temperature power spectrum, but we're getting there, and in the next few years, we should be able to surpass that level. So the question is, how might improve upon the current limit, which is dictated by the temperature power spectrum in the Sachs-Wolfe plateau. And if you go to the next slide, maybe indicate to you what could in principle improve on this. So this is a plot of the B mode power spectrum, again with the data shown there, the best, I'm sorry, the E mode power spectrum. The data points are measurements of the E mode power spectrum. The model lines, the E mode spectrum is shown, as is the B mode power spectrum. And of course, the B mode power spectrum consists of the primordial E mode emission from the interaction of gravitational surface loss scattering. But it also has a component which is from the lensing of the E mode polarization into B modes. The net result is shown as a solid line, the lower of the two solid lines. Sum of those two components. And the lens power spectrum is shown as the dashed line. So there are two bold lines drawn there, one black, one purple. The black one is showing, I've drawn it by hand, but it's pretty accurate, of what the noise level, in multiple by multiple, the noise level in the Planck data. And I've truncated my hand-drawn line at about L of 60 or so. And the same is shown for our expectations for what SPIDER will do. And I've truncated that at L of 10 or so. Now, Planck, of course, has smaller beams than SPIDER, and so extends up to higher multiple than SPIDER does. But the takeaway here is that if you were to extrapolate the solid black line down to low multiples, you'll see where the constraining ability on the tensor to scalar ratio comes from for Planck. It basically intersects the expected level, a very optimistic level of tensor to scalar ratio. The line is shown for R 0.1. Actually, that's not right. I think it's 0.05 in this plot. The only thing that Planck has for actually detecting the B mode signal is to hit the reionization bump in the B mode signal down at a multiple of just a few. And that is a very, very difficult game to play. The galaxy is very problematic at large scales. Anyone familiar with the WMAP polarization analysis at multiple of 8 will appreciate quite how hard it is to to get down and do polarization on these large scales. And there's no reason to think that that Pond Lab and Time of it. In fact, one strategy is less than optimal doing this sort of a thing. So despite what's in the literature, it's going to be very challenging to actually constrain the tensor to scalar ratio directly through the B-mode power spectrum. That isn't to say it won't be possible, but there are very substantial challenges in that analysis. Now, it does, as you'll note, get a very high signal-to-noise measurement of the EE power spectrum and also of the TE power spectrum. And I think there is room for improvement over the current limit on R from Planck, from its own internal measurement of the TE power spectrum. And again, remind you, the power there comes from the fact that the tensor-induced E-mode polarization and the tensor-induced T polarization have a correlation. Correlation does not go to zero at the same place where the scalar-induced TE correlation does. And so you can look for that signature of where the sign of the TE power changes and use that as a measure of the tensor to scalar ratio. So I think there's hopes there, and I think, quite frankly, at least in the near term, that most likely place for Planck to improve on the current R limit. So on about the same scale, there are a batch of new experiments coming online. We have experiments at the South Pole in Chile and from suborbital platforms on balloons like SPIDER, which are all either in the field or are fielding this year, that have fantastically more sensitivity than Planck. So if you go to the next slide. I'm just going to advertise here. It's one of these experiments. It's the only one which is balloon-borne. It's a long-duration balloon-borne polarimeter that has modest angular resolution. So it's only measuring scales from that are larger than about a half a degree. But it has an instrumental sensitivity, which is 5 times of Planck. It's kind of interesting. Planck's detectors are limited by the temperature of the micro-background radiation itself. So in order to build a more sensitive detector, you have to wait a Hubble time for the temperature of the CMB to decrease. Being patient, instead of waiting that long, instead, the only option is to scale up the number of detectors that are in the focal point. So this next batch experiments are all fielding thousands of detectors rather than Planck's dozens in order to achieve that sensitivity increase for Planck. Now, equally as important is the ability to design an instrument which is have as good control over the systematics and survey redundancy so that you can make a very rigorous set of null tests. And that's sort of built in the SPIDER design in a way that Planck really wasn't designed for. Go to the next slide. There's a picture there of SPIDER in the high bay here at Princeton, and below that is the graduate students building it. And just real quickly here, we're hoping to probe a level of about R.03. And if you look at the bottom and plot in this slide, this is from Frace et al. And it's a plot showing the best case scenario for a Planck in blue, for a Planck limit on the tensor to scalar ratio. Again, deriving measurement of the amplitude of that reionization bump in B. And then it's showing on top of that in orange, SPIDER 1 and SPIDER 2, those being two different flights of SPIDER with different frequency coverage. And you'll see that SPIDER bottoms out at about the same that Planck does in the most optimistic scenario. And the reason for that is not statistical power. It's confusion with what we expect in galactic polarization. So Planck has given us a wealth of knowledge about dust emission on the full sky. And it's not all good news. There's quite a bit of polarized dust out there. And we fully expect that the current suite of suborbital CMB polarimeters is going to be limited. We'll have very significant effect power, and that they'll be firmly limited by foreground emission. So the improvement that's shown in that likelihood plot going from spider one to spider two is simply in understanding what that foreground polarization is doing. And red line is sort of showing what we think is a plausible limit, given what we know about polarized foregrounds, for how well one might do on the tensor to scale ratio. Again, being limited by foregrounds ultimately at you know, I think of 10 to the minus 2. Now, I'm sure there are others that disagree with what that amplitude is. I think it's fair to say that we're not going to get to 10 to the minus 4 for very fundamental reasons. The next slide is just an illustration sort of the problem with foregrounds. If you take models that are informed by the Pont polarization data, and you look at the distribution of the contribution to B-mode power of the polarized dust in the cleanest patches of sky, you get basically what's shown in the right-hand plot. So at red is 90 gigahertz, green 150, and blue is 200 gigahertz. And that family line shows distributions of a patch of sky that encompass 2% of the full sky, have an area of 2% of the full sky, in the cleanest part of the whole sky. And the level of B-mode polarization that we expect to pick up from glass formation in each of those. And so that's just an idea. And this is sort of how we target what sensitivity levels with our instruments to achieve. We'd like to sort of image the sky and the B-modes with comparable signal to noise in a number of different frequencies so that we can disambiguate the cosmological emission from the foreground emission. So that's sort of, all of that is to sort of frame what I take on what the situation is for measurements of the B mode and direct limits on the tensor to scalar ratio from the B mode measurements. And again, a couple percent is, I think, realistic, but it'll be hard. Now, there are other things that you can do with getting back to Pont for a moment. There are other things you can say about early universe theories and inflation. And so the next slide is a plot from the non-Gaussianity paper, inflation paper, showing an attempt at doing a reconstruction of the primordial power spectrum from the Pont temperature data. And here I just want to discuss a couple things that I have, you know, a bit of a cautionary tale here. You can stare at these bumps in a very long time and divine all sorts of cosmological implications from them. At these smaller scales, though, you really have to start being careful about a number of things, one of them being the foreground modeling. And illustrate that, if you could go to the next slide, just sort of keep in mind what this image looks like when you go to the next. And this slide shows both the Pont data and then a couple realizations of Pont data generated using the signal and noise covariance that had been published. And what these show are that you have to be very careful when probing your favorite primordial power spectrum model to really take into account the full glory of the covariance of the data. A lot of this covariance is from the noise on the one hand. So, as I said, from the fact that there are correlations induced from the way that we're doing our foreground marginalization, among other things. And those are all incorporated in the likelihood code, but you've got to be pretty careful to explore the full parameter space of what can be accommodated by that covariance. And that's under the assumption that we've caught it all. There are some subtleties that we don't fully understand in the data at these scales. So at the scales specifically are sort of between a multiple of 1,000 and 2,000. So if you go to the next plot, these are some of the things that I worry about at night, although not that much. These are null tests. So again, these are survey null tests at the different frequencies. So 100 gigahertz, 143, and 216. And again, focus in on the area between L of 1,000 and 2,000, where the sample variance is negligible out here compared to the amplitude of the null test failure. So these null tests fail with very high significance, but also with extremely low amplitude.
So certainly for the hundreds, they fail significantly, but with an amplitude which is totally negligible compared to sample current. The situation is less at the shorter wavelengths. And especially for the 217s, we have examples of tests that we can construct that are actually in the DPC paper that was released. And you should just, you know, keep in the back of your mind, we have jackknife ears that are of order 20 to 50 microkelvin squared out between 1500 and 2000. And we don't know where they're coming from fully. We have our suspicions, but we also don't know how they'd manifest themselves in the SUM data. Okay, so now I want to talk real briefly. I'm running a bit long, so I want to briefly talk about the anomalies.
Waiting for consistency, the comments on consistency.
Okay, Cheryl wants to hear the comments on consistency.
Between
W and the point. Yeah. So just real quickly, for the next slide. This is a plot that's showing what's happening on large scales. So this is more anomaly than consistency, but it's not necessarily unrelated. The best fit, remember, the best fit cosmology is constrained entirely by the smaller Engo scales. So scales smaller than a degree or so. And that totally dictates, in the context of lambda CDM, how much power we expect to see at these large scales up to a multiple between 250. To a very good approximation, WMAP and PONT see the same thing on these scales. I'll qualify that statement in a minute. For the purposes of this slide, they're in good agreement, and yet in disagreement with the lambda CDM that's derived from the smaller scales. That statement true of WMAP 7 and of WMAP 9. It's more true of PONC, not because the sky looks that much different to PONC on these scales, but because there's more power at the large scales. So this is odd, and chi-square doesn't tell the whole story, because, as you can see in the sort of the right panel, it's a systematic effect where everything is skewed very low. So even though the chi-square isn't horrific, there's something odd going on at large scales, and quite frankly, I don't think anybody has any idea what it is. But it's quite robust. Planck and WMAP agree completely in this regard. Okay, and so, you know, in terms of the anomalies, everything that WMAP saw, Planck sees and agrees with. It's a bit higher statistical significance with Planck, not so much because the data, but because the best fit model prefers a bit more power. Okay, now what about this with WMAP? That's the next slide. We've seen for several years now this puzzling result. These images aren't real easy to see, but what's being done in the top two panels are cross power spectra of Planck data with WMAP data on the one hand. And it's actually the ratio of Planck with one of the WMAP differencing assemblies divided by the ratio of two other WMAP differencing assemblies. And you can play, so this thing is getting a measure of the agreement on the sky between Planck at 100 gigahertz and WMAP at 90 gigahertz. And these are not in power units, they're in units of microkelvin because of the ratio. And the same is shown on the right plot, the V-band differencing assemblies. Now these have map in the denominator. We've done it with Planck in the denominator, and you get exactly the same result, only with higher significance because you don't suffer from the WMAP noise penalty. And the exercise of doing that measurement and averaging the ratio of signal amplitude between, roughly speaking, L of 150 and 200. That's what's shown in the table. So it's very quite consistent, although there does seem to be a diversion amongst the different differencing assemblies. But the takeaway is that we see it very consistently between WMAP and the Planck data, and yet we don't see any
in the same figure of merit, sees nothing anomalous with the LFI 70 gigahertz, which is the last in that table. So those, the PONC gigahertz and the LFI 70 gigahertz seem very consistent. And yet we see about, on average, 1% in amplitude, 2% in power on those angular scales between PONC and WMAP. And that's true of the gigahertz. It's equally true of the 150 and 217 gigahertz data. And this has been known in the collaboration at degree scales for a long time now. It's only been more recently appreciated that this sort of 2% deficit extends down to the lowest multiple. So that's what the lower plot is. If you look at the average power at multiples less than about 40, you see less power in PONC than you do in WMAP, again, by about 2%. Now, again, that number is 2%, and it's seemingly independent of multiple, with the exception of quadrupole. So the quadrupole is very odd, and I don't have a good plot of it here, unfortunately. But PONC actually sees more power in the quadrupole than WMAP does, and that's a mystery. So, but quickly, just to nail a point home, if you can go back one slide, recall that that discrepancy between WMAP and PONC is about 2%, whereas you can see that in the right panel slide, the deficit with respect to lambda CDM is between 10 and 15%. So they're completely different. They have nothing to do with one another. Okay, so getting back, if you go forward back to the calibration slide, I don't know, are there any questions about that? Is that clear? Okay.
So yeah, so the agreement between LFI and HFI.
Yes.
So for example, one question one might have is what will be the effect of the beams on this first
yeah.
And
yeah.
So I guess the fact that the LFI and HFI agree so well almost rules out that possibility, or what do you think?
Pull it out. So if you go to the next slide, it's just that. So the first thing we do is we scratch our head about the PONC data, and we ask, is there anything in our understanding of the beams, for instance, that could cause there to be problem in extrapolating the dipole calibration out to smaller angular scales. So remember, for PONC, this extrapolation is huge, right? We're going from the dipole all the way out to a multiple of 2,000, right? So that's three orders of magnitude in angular scale that we have to extrapolate our calibration. So we worry quite a lot about it. When we add up all that we can think of, we get what are essentially the right-hand here incorporate the worst fears about how badly we could have done in the beam modeling. And we get about 0.5% in solid angle, and so that translates to something less than in the window function and power on the CMB, you can sort of think of that as being twice the uncertainty in beam solid angle. And at 100 gigahertz, that's about 0.5%. At 143, it's to a tenth. And the 143 and 217 are dominating the statistical weight out at degree angular scales. So we really can't for it in either our beam errors or in our calibration uncertainty. Was there a question? I'm sorry, was there a question? So then I'd ask, if it's not the absolute calibration on the dipole and it's not the beams, then is it residual systematics in the PONC data that are somehow resulting in a decrement in power? And so if you go to the plot, the best way I think to ask that question is this: what's the amplitude of the residuals that you see in tests? And when you do that experiment, you pick our sort of catch-all null test, which is the survey difference. We have very statistically significant failures, but they're at an amplitude which is tiny, a fraction of a microkelvin squared. and this is to be compared with a level of degree scales. So nothing systematic in the data that can explain this at all. So it's a mystery, and it remains a mystery. I think we've had some useful discussions with the local dubbing recruiter, and I think that there's consensus between us that there's at least two things going on. There's something weird going on with the quadrupole, which may or may not be related to bipolar operation. But did that probably have to do with the degree scale issue? And we're still searching for an explanation of what that degree scale issue is. I don't have any brilliant conclusion for you about what it is at this point. I do think, though, that we're coming to the conclusion that there are at least different things going on, one affecting the degree scales and something else going on with the very largest scales. And the reason for that is essentially that you can cook up instrumental reasons for each to be there, but you can't cook up instrumental reason for them both for that 2% mismatch to extend from sub-degree scales all the way down to the dipole. You really can't cook anything up that would do that in either experiment. So I think I'll just stop there, and I think that's...
Okay, well, thanks a lot for doing this. Any questions? From Paris, you want to know what he was saying? So to be absolutely clear, so the things like the elasticity of the beam, so we normally approximate beams as Emusel symmetric, and we use circularized beam. For Planck, how important that approximation is, that understood?
Yeah, it's fairly well understood. It's just to back up a little bit. So when we talk about the Planck beam, we're really talking about a combination of the way that the readout electronics plays with the beam. Because of the nature of the scan strategy, the two are degenerate. And really not just approximately degenerate, they're actually degenerate. And so when we talk about the Planck beam, we're talking about the combination of our understanding of the electronics and the the physical beam of the telescope. And with our scan, the beams are not nearly as well symmetrized as they are with the WMAP scan strategy. But on the other hand, the beams are intrinsically much more symmetric. And the other thing that's true about them is that we've measured them to a bit more than an order of magnitude deeper off of the Mars data than WMAP can off the Jupiter data. So we don't need to rely on any model of what's happening in the beam all the way down to sort of negative 40, 45 dB. Now, that's not really your question. Your question was more about the symmetrization. So that's discussed in some detail in the beam paper. What's done there is when we compute the window function, we actually are using the full sky map and the pointing history in order to build up a Hitz-weighted average beam or effective beam, which introduces the necessary symmetrization into our knowledge of the scanning beam, and then propagates to the window function. In order to poke at how good an approximation that is, right? So that's an approximate. We're necessarily representing the window function as a function of L, which is approximate. That approximation is very good at the level that we're talking about here, at the level of 0.1%. And one way you can poke at that is to see how much that effective beam varies from place to place on the sky if you look at restricted portions. And there's actually a histogram of that value in the beams paper. And it's not enough to account for this. And, well, first of all, the amplitude is not enough to account for the 2% effect in power. And second of all, we think to zeroth order, we've got it right. We've dealt with that. So it would be sort of a higher order effect if we've somehow done that incorrectly.
Yeah.
But there is there's a table in the newspaper that goes in some detail about the degree of variation in the amplitude of the window function and the beam solid angle from place to place in the sky.
There's another question.
I have a different question. Which weight do you give to these anomalies that you find at large scales? I mean, the beauty of lambda CDM is it has few parameters that can be falsified. And especially, it's very predictive for large scales. That's really nice. It's linear regime, everything should be known, and you find these discrepancies. So, I have no idea how you see them. Is that really a big blow to lambda CDM? Or, I just have no explanation how within lambda CDM I could produce this type of anomalies.
Yeah, well, I all I can say is that the data appear to be remarkably robust to the impact is there, and I have no idea what the implications are. But the fact that it's measured to be almost exactly the same in both WMF and PONC, I think is I certainly wish it off as possibly being a foreground issue or whatnot with just the WMF data, but. You know, with the PONC data seeing exactly the same thing over more than a factor of four in wavelength, there's no other explanation than it's primordial.
So let me perhaps push this question a bit further. I mean, a lambda CDM you cannot split it in two. You cannot split the there's the small distance part and the long distance part. It's one model. Would you go so far to say that at least without any, more complicated inflation and more complicated structures and so on, you have falsified the simplest model?
Is that question for me?
Yes.
I would be a little more cautious and say.
No, that's. I try to provoke a bit, but.
So you need the power to be lower earlier, so light on a bit bigger, so it's still a steeper.
No mind, of course. It's clear. If you start making structure in your primordial spectrum, you can, in principle, get whatever you want. But the assumption of all what we have all the time is that we have a relatively simple primordial spectrum without particular features. I mean, that is what I call the standard lambda CDM model. And the question is that one falsified or not?
No.
I mean, simple statement index, perhaps a little tilde.
The answer is no, because the statistical significance of the anomaly is less than 3 sigma. And you can't take evidence for less than 3 sigma ruled out.
Okay, so that's exactly the type of answer I want. You say the whole effect is only 3 sigma. And we have not to worry too much about it.
But it would not be a huge worry anyway.
There are several different anomalies being discussed. And I want to ask about the so-called hemispheric or north-south anomaly, because I'm a little confused as to how that may depend on the range of L that you look at and just exactly how much it's associated with the ecliptic. Can you comment on that?
So it's true that there are a number of anomalies, and I've only pointed out, in my opinion, the most robust of them. It's the overall decrement in power at large scales. You're right that there are other ones. There's the kink that's evident if you go, I'm just seeing which slide it is, respect to the it's just obvious at L30, it's that slide 9. Between L of 20 and 30, there's just a very clear kink in the measured power spectrum. PONC sees exactly the same thing that, so I'm just referring to the kink that you can see starting at about L of 20 and continuing up to L of 30 or so. It's in both the PONC and WMAP data with about the same signal to noise. It's very robust. So there's no question but that it's on the sky. I have no idea what it is. Now, that's not the only isotropy issue. There's a whole paper about, this is by isotropy, the alignment of the quadrupole and octupole. I'm very agnostic about that. And I think you could cook up a laundry list of reasons why you might not worry that really to the extent that you would scratch your head about some of these features at larger scale.
So I think what Marjorie was asking specifically about was the dipole modulated power asymmetry that now, according to some of the plots, is supposed to extend up to L's of around 1,000 or something. Yeah, I mean, it's there at the beginning, and it's a sort of 10% effect, and then it drops, and it rises again later, according to one of your plots.
I don't know what to make of it there, but I would point you, you have to be careful, depending on which angular scale you're talking about, you need to be careful to note that we know that we have residuals in our null test.
And around which L was that again? That was?
Let's see, so I'm just trying to find the figure here. It's slide, it's Beth CN slide, which is it? 35 is a good one. There are other models that are shown in the deep paper. One more slide.
So
what's hard to see here is what's happening, between L of 500 and 1500. It's obvious that there's stuff going on beyond that. The full test residuals at the amplitude of 10 to 20 microkelvin squared are quite high significant in any number of the null tests that you can construct right around the beginning of the damping tail. So far I haven't gotten too excited about them.
See you.
I was just wondering if the, low L, if it's at the 3 sigma level now, if it's really in effect, are you going to be able to push it beyond 3 sigma with the second year release, or what will that take to achieve that sensitivity?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear. If we could push it beyond 3 sigma, the low L?
Yeah,
what do you need to go beyond 3 sigma? Is that something that you have in the can, or?
I guess I have two comments there. One, we're not in a situation that's much different than WMAP, but we, in that, there's actually no noise whatsoever in either instrument at those scales, right? So we agree to within up to this 2% factor, we completely agree that there's not enough power there. So more data is not going to help us. And what the level of significance of it is, it depends how you do your stats. The chi-squared is terrific, but on the other hand, all of the band powers are low, and I don't quite know what to do with that.
May I make a comment? With the polarization data, you can test the hypothesis, for example, that there's a feature in the primordial.
Yeah, you can hopefully, that's true. So you can hopefully constrain, I guess, some class of ideas about what might be going on by the low L polarization data. These are at scales that are quite difficult to do polarization work at, especially with pump.
Let me ask again about these anomalies. I mean, I have a poor theorist's question. I'm not really going into details of all that, but I hear all the time these anomalies, and my question is really, I have to weigh their significance. Of course, you can, if you look at thousands of features, you will always find some anomalies, especially if you have cosmic variance. But on the other hand, some of these anomalies are the most basic things you can do. For example, isotropy. If I want to judge isotropy, I look into hemispheres, and you find deviations from that. And somehow I'm not really very happy about it, I must say. I mean, because these are not things where you can just say, if you take everything together, my feeling, it's not just 3 sigma, because it's coming in several different instances, and it's not really giving what you would expect from lambda CDM to look like at large scales. I cannot help it.
So what you're seeing on the sky is a realization of lambda CDM. Right?
Sure.
So the fact that you see power in different hemispheres, you didn't actually account in that 3 sigma for which two hemispheres did you judge to maximize that statistic that made the power different. that's just one example of a posteriori selection effect.
Yeah, but of course, if you charge isotropy, you in principle take all angles, and then you charge, is it symmetric in all angles? I mean, that's the most simple test I can ever imagine.
And then you will find one
where it's maximum. If there's a real anisotropy, you will find one where it's maximum, and that gives you the direction. But there is no bias in this type of test for the question of isotropy. I mean, it's not some far-fetched thing. It's the first thing you would ever do if you want to test for it.
Once you get to really high L, and if you really believe in lambda CDM, there's absolutely no reason to have different power in different hemispheres. No matter, you know, it's got to be really small. Mm-hmm. If you look at the, you know, any random realization, you just have so many pixels of that angular size that it's just going to be down by
higher likelihood.
Yeah, so the fact that you see a different power spectrum in different halves of the sky, I think it is really weird, right? I mean, so either that's fundamental, or there's something in the instruments we don't understand. But it's got to be.
So were those power spectra estimated with the rigor that the full sky one was?
Yeah, I don't know what the details of the estimation.
So I couldn't quite hear that. Was that a question to me?
No.
We're sharing our feelings about the asymmetry.
The small scale hemispherical asymmetry?
Yeah.
I mean, you expressed doubts about the smaller scale contributions. But I know Chris Murata has a limit on it from quasars later, like 10 to the 4.
He's going to talk about it here tomorrow if he gets well, because he's really sick. I guess I can imagine if you somehow have some weird like local structure that's lensing one side of the sky different than the other sky, mm-hmm. then maybe that will do something, but...
Are you on this paper?
Which paper?
Yeah, it's like between statistics.
No.
Is there anyone here who's worked on that paper? Is anyone coming? Who's left on
there? Chris Gorski is
going to
do it.
Right.
Yeah, well,
but he's not going to be here before.
I forget. He's just down the road, so he'll definitely be here at the conference as well before.
Okay.
Chris has thought a lot about it, too.
Yeah, I'm Bob Kirshner. I'm not a primordial cosmologist, but I am here at the KIPP. And I had, temporarily, I had a question about the way you described the Hubble constant discrepancy. You said the Planck results were model independent, and it made me wonder what you meant by that, since, of course, it depends on the whole cosmological model to get the distance back to redshift of 1,000, the angular scales, and so on. So I would have said it's completely model dependent. And what's interesting is that the measurements that we get nearby, which are, of course, from a completely different approach, don't agree with that particular model, that you need a little more, you know, if you just look at the supernova data, you would say W has to be less than minus one or something like that. You know, you could invent some other way to talk about it, but it's not model independent, in my opinion, and this difference is kind of interesting. I'm sorry, you dropped out when you said you completely agreed with me.
Independent, what I'm referring to more is astrophysically model independent.
I don't know what you're saying exactly here. What kind of model are you not invoking?
It's a purely geometrical measurement.
Yeah,
right.
Right. But it involves that whole integral, which has all the pieces of the cosmological model.
Yes, absolutely.
I just wanted to make a rhetorical point, you know.
Well, it's a lambda CDM determination of H.
Use model independent.
No, it's not. It's of the distance to the scattering surface. Please, let's not get confused.
Now they take the parameters of the model.
It's not H naught. It's the distance to the scattering surface.
It's an estimate of.
Yeah. In turn, talk about it in that way. I
understand. Once you have lambda CDM plus it,
If you change W, then the estimate completely changes.
Exactly. So that's the point. That's what we usually, you know, that's how we talk about the supernova.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same problem, and it's an interesting problem, I think.
Also, the standard Planck model has a non-zero neutrino mass in it. That's that changes Hubble, the central value of the things.
Yeah, well, we need to talk about model independent. There you go. Thank you. Okay, now I understand.
Well, but the H naught result is pretty independent of your assumptions about neutrino mass.
I know that, but the central value shifts a little bit if you assume the neutrino mass is non-zero. I'm not talking about the error bar. I completely agree with you, but
But even the neutral value shifts the other way, right? It becomes more tension, and as the neutrino mass goes up, you're in that much more tension with the HST value.
Yeah.
You can see it if you to a.
Get a little on from experiment.
Fine. So you can see it. I think there. And physically, as you bump the neutrino mass up, you're suppressing the power even more.
Yes, right? That's right. You're right.
What is actually driving H naught lower? Is it the I mean, how much of it is driven by the calibration? The calibration error of this like 2% or whatever it is? Because that, I thought, changed the ratio of the first to the third peak, right? That's so it drives omega matter up and then H.
So the fact that the Planck is finding lower H naught is directly coming from the lower first peak relative to W naught.
Right. So
that's why that first peak is very important to understand.
Yeah, well, the H naught value is being sensitive, even if you bump an overall scaling up with that percent, just for that reason. It's the ratio of peak heights and it's the tilt.
Right, but I thought the calibration error was L dependent though, right? It was some weird L dependent effect that you had the ratio actually at the first peak went down, but the third peak didn't change. I mean, yeah, because obviously if you just change the normalization, nothing happens. Right. You just change the normalization of the primordial spectrum. But, I mean, so you have to have some weird L-dependent calibration effect that changes the ratio of the first to the third and then drives up omega matter, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Bill, are you willing to share your speculations about the quadrifold that you're discussing with Gary and so on?
I think you've probably heard all of the speculation I have. The amount of power that we see is a lot higher than WMAP, a factor of 2 or so. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to square. So the first things to track down are to what degree are the quadrupole values self-consistent within Paul? They're quite self-consistent within the different subsets of the WMAP data. My opinion, and you know, this is completely my opinion and not that of any collaboration that I know of, but my opinion is that there is likely something at the largest scales. There's likely something in the Planck data that's a bit off. And my opinion is based solely on anecdotal observations of dispersion within the Planck data at those large scales. But again, I want to emphasize that this is a very different issue than the degree scale effect. Essentially all angular scales above L of 50. I think they're two totally independent issues.
Is there a discrepancy when you use the same masks?
Yes. So that 2% value from L of 100 up to 400 is completely independent of the mask, from 80% of the sky down to 20% of the sky.
No, I mean the quadrupole.
Oh, the quadrupole? That's a good question. And I personally haven't probed that.
So I think it's independent of mass because when you take the difference between WMAP's map and Planck map, you actually see that quadrupole by eye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a very well-defined quadrupole in the sky that's aligned with the ecliptic plane.
Yeah.
So it's very, so it's independent of
mass. I just get uneasy about talking about quadrupole when you use different masks because it's, it's not the whole sky. But
quadrupole is such a big feature in the sky. If you take the difference between two maps, you see quadrupole. You see hot, hot, cold, cold by eye. So you don't have to go through power spectrum to do this.
No, I'm just saying that you've got the galaxy, and that's a big feature in the sky, and so you have a different basis.
You don't have to reconstruct it. That's what I'm trying to say.
So I just want to...
You mask the sky, you take the difference from the two maps, yes. You see quadrupole just jumping at you.
Right.
And the direction of quadrupole is... perpendicular to the galaxy.
You're just saying you see a large scale feature when you take the difference map.
It's not purely quadrupole. Actually, first thing you see dipole. And after you remove dipole, the second thing you see is a pure quadrupole with a big amplitude.
Right.
It's instructive to just plot the public maps and plot the M values for the L's between 2 and 10 for both the map and plot. It's kind of striking.
And what about the null test just for the quadrupole?
You know, I frankly, I know that there's a bit more dispersion down there than I can account for, but I haven't done any rigorous test of that. So I hope that that's one of the things that will be included in the publication. If in it, and it's not there for it.
Sorry, we didn't hear. Was that a good joke? We didn't hear.
It was a joke. I was asking if anybody potentially reviews the consistency paper and they don't find it in the paper, that they should ask for it.
Okay. Can I ask you something now? You know the low L plot that you showed, which has the cosmic variance error bars? Isn't it much more useful to show a plot just with the noise error bars for that?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to get at. So if you're getting at consistency with lambda CDM, then no.
No, consistency between WMAP and Planck.
Yeah, ratios are, let's just make sure we're talking about the same plot. The ones that are on slide 38.
Yeah, it's a last plot in the parameter space.
Yeah. So those error bars, those don't have any sample variance in them.
Really? They look a bit big to me. Sorry.
The scale is pretty small.
Yeah.
Not what those error bars are. Because we don't have, what you'd like to do with these, ideally, is to run through a big Monte Carlo of noise ensembles to see what you're expecting mm-hmm. noises. And we've not done them. Instead, mm-hmm. what we've done is we've just taken version in the publicly available data mm-hmm. in the absence of a public noise model, which you'll note is not published. Data. So this is, has the fruit of being able to be reproduced with the public, but it's not really what you'd like to do. But in any case, if you just do that, and the cross powers, look at the variance within an N, that's all that's shown as the error bar. Mm-hmm. So it's, I agree with you that that's not the rigorous thing to do, but it is a good indicator of what the statistical error is. And we're sort of cheating because a better estimate of that statistical error is in the second column, the ratio sigma in that table. And that gives you an idea of what the statistical uncertainty is. Does that answer your
question? It does, thank you.
Couldn't make it. It's almost certainly more pleasant in Santa Barbara than it is here.